Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Robert Strong. Robert Strong's first book of poetry, Puritan Spectacle, was published by Elixir Press in 2006. He received a PhD in creative writing from the University of Denver and an MFA from Naropa University. His undergraduate work was done in the Faith, Peace, and Justice program at Boston College. He is an assistant professor at SUNY Canton. He is the editor of the Autumn House Anthology of American Spiritual Poetry, published in 2007. Hi, Robert. How you doing?
Hi, Jan. Great. It's great to be here.
Good to meet you. And we're really grateful to Autumn House Press, especially Michael Sims, who is now the executive editor of Autumn House, for bringing you to Pittsburgh. So you're gonna focus today on the new anthology, right?
Yes.
Of American spiritual poetry. So go ahead and tell us about it.
Well, I was thinking about how to enter into the anthology today for the show. One of the things that coming to Pittsburgh and talking with so many different great groups of people, poets and audiences, different groups from the community, is that you could map various routes through this anthology that charts the arc of American spiritual poetry from the 1500s to 2006, really. You can talk about faith, you can talk about doubt, you can talk about nature. But for a poetry-focused show on the radio where we only have language to communicate with the audience, I thought it might be fun to dive into the problem of language, which is tackled from the very beginning and all the way to the present day in this work, the problem of articulating the ineffable, that which we cannot articulate. And I think that is the place, that difficult place, where poetry and spirituality meet. They're both trying to say something that we know can't be said. And out of that tension comes the beauty and the fertility of the work. So if you don't mind, I'll dive right into some of the native songs that begin the anthology. This is from the Inuit. Delightful, the animals. There is no song about them. Words for a song are hard to find. Seals on the ice down here. When I found a few words, I fit them to music. The seals left for their breathing holes. Delightful, the animals. There is no song about them. Words hard to catch. Antlered caribou on the land down here. When I found a few words, I fit them to music. When they crossed the plains, delightful, the animals. There is no song about it. Words hard to catch. Bearded seals on the ice down here. When I found a few words, I fit them to music. When they left for their breathing holes. And what I love about that one is it brings together the natural world, the desire to speak of it, the inability to speak of it. And in the first instance, that the words coming out in song in the first moment of breathing out and breathing out in spirit of the natural world and our creation in it.
Yeah, it's nice that it says, you know, there is no song, because it's I hate when people make claims, you know, on something as large as spirituality, you know, especially, or in any poem, when people make large claims, it seems that the only response is to balk at large claims, you know. But go ahead, read more poems.
Well, on that, the issue of making claims, that's one of the great things about coming out and hearing people's response to the anthology, and the audience in Pittsburgh is a sharp one, and has pointed out that what they enjoy about the anthology is it doesn't do that. It avoids that. And so there are many different angles in the book. I think people are interested in the spiritual in America, but very wary of it because of the ways it is used, perhaps more so today. I'm not sure. And so they're cautious with the word spiritual. And the ability to put an anthology out there that Autumn House Press offered me was wonderful because now people have this book that they're not scared of.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, why don't you read more poems so we can not be scared of them?
Not be scared of them. Well, I'll keep staying on the issue of language and the difficulty of it, I'll take us right up to Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson, who writes some essays about it that are poetics essays. And he writes, as we go back in history, language becomes more picturesque until its infancy when it is all poetry, or all spiritual facts are represented by natural symbols. The same symbols are found to make the original elements of all languages. It has moreover been observed that the idioms of all languages approach each other in passages of the greatest eloquence and power. And as this is the first language, so it is the last. The immediate dependence of language upon nature, this conversion of an outward phenomenon into a type of somewhat in human life, never loses its power to affect us. A man's power to connect thought with its proper symbol and so to utter it depends on the simplicity of his character, that is, upon his love of truth and his desire to communicate it without loss. The corruption of man is followed by the corruption of language. That's a selection out of his essay, Nature, and he also has a very interesting essay entitled Poetry and Imagination, which we don't see anthologized as much or published in his collected works, in which he expounds on this theme a little bit. He says that every correspondence we observe in mind and matter suggests a substance older and deeper than either of these old nobilities. We see the law gleaming through. The poet who plays with it best justifies himself, is most profound and most devout. I love how he brings in this idea of playfulness. We have this thing that we cannot approach, and the best way that you can handle it in life and poetically is to play with it and see what you can gather out of it.
Out of it, you mean language?
Yes, and the impossibility of language doing what we need it to do, which is to speak of the ultimate essences that we carry inside of us.
If you just tune in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Robert Strong. And he's reading from the new anthology entitled Joyful Noise, an anthology of American spiritual poetry. He's the editor, and it's published by Autumn House Press. So, you know, just when you're reading from Emerson, and of course, I'm sitting here thinking of the problems with gender in that quote, and you know, we're talking about, you know, transportation of the spirit, and yet we're still hamstrung by this he and he and he. You know, that's what I'm hearing, because I am who I am, and you know, it's unfortunate. And so maybe we could hear some women poets in there.
Absolutely.
You know, because it's kind of ironic, you know, to talk about that you know, that great freedom of the spirit, and yet we're still hearing all this maleness.
Unidirectional masculinity.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, the masculinity tends to thrust forth at us in that way. So let's go straight to Dickinson, who you want playfulness that mm-hmm. will disturb that unidirectional tendency and continue to struggle with this problem of language in a much more three-dimensional way. This is a poem. The title we have here is A Word Made Flesh Is Seldom, which is also the first line. And she plays with some words in here. We'll hear the word expire. which comes at us in the sense of breathing out, and also the word condescension, which we have a particular connotation for, but she's using to mean condescension, descend to be among us, to come down among us, which is a wonderful use of the word. Emily Dickinson, a word made flesh is seldom and tremblingly partook, nor then perhaps reported. But have I not mistook? Each one of us has tasted with ecstasies of stealth the very food debated to our specific strength. A word that breathes distinctly has not the power to die. Cohesive as the spirit, it may expire if he, made flesh and dwelt among us, could condescension be like this consent of language, this loved philology. And so it's still he who's coming down, who she's struggling with, but then the love of language coming down among us and fragmenting in a way that is very difficult and wonderful for Emily Dickinson. And she's such a challenge to read and so wonderful. I want to just go right ahead and read the next selection that we have in the anthology from Emily. It was not saint, it was too large, nor snow, it was too small. It only held itself aloof like something spiritual.
Yeah, it's nice. I mean, there's a great range of writers in that anthology, too. I mean, it's nice that, you know, as it moves into the more contemporary work, there's, you know, a great range of gay writers and writers of color. And how did you put together this anthology, and what were some of the challenges?
The challenges were whittling it down to 400 pages, which was a wonderful challenge. My process was, in order to avoid the sort of the kind of labels of and connotations that we have in contemporary America with the spiritual, was to throw the net as wide as possible. And it's very gratifying that you've noticed that it's captured or released as many people as possible with as many different voices. That was my main goal, to avoid hanging that label on any one particular hook, because that's exactly what we draw back from these days. And I hope that it is successful in doing that. It's interesting that the contemporary living writers are where you can do that work. The rest is digging through history at things that have been covered up by history, and we've done good work. Other people, scholars and activists, have done good work on that, but it will be an endless job, I feel.
Yeah.
And fear.
Yeah.
So I'd love to read a poem by our contemporary Elizabeth Robinson. This is continuing with the struggle with language. There's this wonderful poem here entitled Speak. Address is its own metaphysics. See, the hereafter in which I speak now solely in your voice. Certain tunes tune themselves this way. United, but how shall I ever know, speaking in a voice that I would adopt from you? Here is a book in which the both of us believe in God. One reads from the front, and the other from the back. So states the divine voice that there is a middle. Where is it that we do not meet? I speak in your voice to say that what I heard is also what I said, that there is a word drawn out, something less than faith, and where I do not know, but that a thing I desire could extend from me. Willful religion, that a voice could have its impact. I carried close my small transcendent like a bomb, but I have your voice now. The mutual God is all immanent, the center that dispenses with pronouns. And I love that poem for its bringing together bringing together and meeting in the middle in this divine space of multiple voices coming to join in some sort of community of understanding. One of the things that I've been talking about with audiences here is the issue of community, since each one of these poems obviously is written by an individual voice. And at what point do we come together to struggle with these issues together? Mm-hmm. And that poem seems to get at that in a nice way.
Did you have any writers who were hesitant to be included in an anthology related to spirituality?
I did. I had some interesting conversations, or at least correspondences, and it was something that I was very wary of. So I approached the anthology in an interesting way for an editor. Normally, it would be an editor's job to read through piles of any author's book and pick. But I was extremely wary of calling someone up and saying, hey, I love your spiritual poem. It seemed a dangerous approach. So I asked poets if they would send me a handful of what they considered appropriate for to live under such a label. And I received things that I may not have normally picked. There's poems about frogs and poems that I think are about origami and things like that. There was a senior American poet whose name I won't mention who wrote me a wonderful letter that was a bit insulted that I would, knowing his work, that I would consider this. He said, I'm a lifelong committed atheist, and anyone who's known my work should know that, and this is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But I also have Alan Dugan, who was a famous curmudgeon, a Marxist, radical atheist in here. But he had his doubts as an atheist, as people of faith have doubts. And so his widow was kind enough to – and understanding enough about Dugan's work to give us permission to use some of his doubting, skeptical poems. Mm-hmm.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Robert Strong, and he's reading from the new anthology entitled Joyful Noise, an anthology of American spiritual poetry, and it's just out from Autumn House Press. And I think you all know Autumn House Press, which is founded and housed in Pittsburgh by the executive editor Michael Sims, who's really a great supporter of poetry, and we're really lucky to have him here in Pittsburgh. So I wonder I have some requests. I don't know if you'd be willing to read any of these, but
I'd love to.
There's a Mark Doty poem, a Jane Mead poem, and any of the Gertrude Stein poems from Tender Buttons.
Throw the gauntlet down. I would love to read all of those. Since I'm warmed up, should I try one of the Steins?
Sure, go ahead.
Do you have the page there? Let's see. And that the Jane Mead poem is beautiful, almost haiku-like piece. Stein, page 162, for those of you following along at home. Okay. This is – I'll read – did you have one in particular?
No, go ahead.
Okay. I'll read – this is a selection from Tender Buttons from the section Rooms. A religion, almost a religion, any religion, a quintal in religion, a relying and a surface and a service in indecision and a creature and a question and a syllable in answer and more counting and no quarrel and a single scientific statement and no darkness and no question and an earned administration and a single set of sisters and an outline and no blisters and the section seeing yellow and the center having spelling and no solitude and no quaintness and yet solid, quite solid, and the single surface centered and the question in the placard and the singularity, is there a singularity? And the singularity, why is there a question? And the singularity, why is the surface outrageous? Why is it beautiful? Why is it not when there is no doubt? Why is anything vacant? Why is not disturbing a center, no virtue? Why is it when it is, and why is it when it is, and there is no doubt, there is no doubt that the singularity shows? Wow.
Thanks.
Thank you for asking to read that. It's a prayer, and as someone pointed out recently, it seems to be an attempt to remove that troubling relationship between us and language by repeating over and over again, forcing us to be there in the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, inside of it.
Yeah.
The Mark Doty poem is Page 246.
246. This is a real treat to read Mark Doty, an early encourager of mine when I was a young punk flipping burgers on the Cape and thinking that I could write some poetry. He was a wonderful teacher early on. This is Theory of Multiplicity. I dislike the laundromat on 16th Street in the winter. Since the single aisle between the rows of washers and dryers is too narrow to allow one to sit down, and the women who work there doing the laundry of others seem generally to resent one's in-the-wayness, and why aren't you paying them to do your laundry anyway? But in summer, it's fine. You can read on the street in white plastic chairs set out for this purpose, or watch people go by, or, as I used to like to do one summer, look into the garden someone had made next door, right on the edge of the sidewalk, spilling onto the pavement, surprisingly wild with prairie grasses, a shrubby purple coneflower, a strapping and frowsy black-eyed Susan, even a few bees drowsing through it. How do they live in Manhattan? And once, when I had been leaning back on the legs of the white chair and staring into the garden, I thought of myself as one of its many viewers. What I knew was this singular aspect, what I could see from this vantage in this light, but its actuality consisted in its being seen multiply, color and dimension attracting the gaze of many. Those who did not ignore it in their hurry took it in from the particular height or angle afforded them. What was the garden but the sum of all those instances of looking, however hurried or casual? Perception carried, loved, considered, dis or regarded. Though it was late in the season, the frost probably not far off, it didn't seem to matter. The fullness of the garden, the late afternoon slanting down from the London plane trees with their already yellowing and thinning leaves, sunlight humming into the stalks and the flowers, the garden I saw one occasion of many. And this was in some way an accomplishment, a contribution to the work of the whole, ensuring that the garden was seen, being one who helped to make the garden known. It took all of us to see it. No one could assemble that vantage we made together. If anyone could, it would be the vision of God, which is not God exactly, that theoretical viewpoint, but a satisfying gesture in that direction, a participation. I felt in that moment entirely complete. The next summer, the garden was sparse, not well tended, and offered no consolation.
Nice. Thank you for reading that.
Wonderful. And the turn at the end is something that we hear often, this sort of doubting or the loss of the inspiration of the divine or the natural world. We hear a lot of in the earlier centuries, but not too much of that true honestness about the way our lives go up and down in the contemporary work. So I was very pleased that Mark sent us this poem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nice one. I want to make time to hear at least a couple of your poems. So I think we have time for another from the anthology if you have one in mind.
Okay. Well, since I mentioned some of the poems that arrived on my doorstep that I may not have picked out if I hadn't had the help of the authors, I'd love to read this one by a young poet named Catherine Mang from the San Francisco Bay Area. This is Ode to One in 1,000. How you are prayerful from conception, how your coat is chosen. Red poppy of wedding day, white as fine china at a wake, blue as both directionless extremes, a green wheel turning. Your perfect square slid from the rice paper stack, belly exposed. You are not folded, but measured and creased. Triangle, triangle, open mouth, diamond same to each side. Thin kite ribbing the shape of the sky. I love you when you are pronged and prone as if to expose your quick needle wit before your neck is chosen, before your wings are turned down like banana skin and arched against the brace of the index finger and the flat pressure of thumb. I love you best when you are two erect tails with two broad wings, two ends to the same story, both ready to take flight. When you are about to be bird, self before it is I, slender sadness, the tears of things going on without pause, the moment before you are inevitable. A thought becomes prayer only when released from the mind. The head is a tail unbent until the tail is recognized. This is your one decision. How one end is always perfect by comparison, your one flaw tucked into your sturdy neck and pinched into your frontlet. You've known from the first alignment, the first horizon dividing earth from sky, that holiness is folded into you, the shape of it alighting in the hand.
Okay. And if you could read a poem from Puritan Spectacle, your own book that just came out, well, in 2006 from Elixir Press, that would be great.
Okay. I have a poem right at the beginning of the book that deals with language in the way we've been talking about it today. I try and invent America at the beginning in language and in presence and so forth. And this would focus more on the language. And the title is Selah, which is an untranslatable word from the Bible. We don't know exactly what it means. Selah. Listen, wounding the head of the house by discovering the foundation unto the throat. The word is answered in place of thunder. More like a proof that water would, eventually, dissolve all earth's inhabitants. Like complaining, and then the spirit is overwhelmed through the mouth passage. Tongues wet like a sword with bitter words, they shall fall upon themselves, and the streets will flow with horrible saliva. One problem is thinking continually with the mouth, is the thought of small muscles lipping across milk teeth. The earliest mouths make not such labor exactly. There is no effort, just babes, well-greased, easy, and irritating condemnation. The trance and deep terrifying thirst make as a moth continuously flaming in the mouth. The word is made in a heart to just stay there, okay?
That is Robert Strong reading from his book, Puritan Spectacle. And he has been reading from the anthology Joyful Noise, an anthology of American spiritual poetry, of which he is the editor, and it's published by Autumn House Press. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Jan.
It's been great. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Alan Wadey. Our sound engineers are Joseph Wilk and Lauren Wolf. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody here on Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP.
She had a smile that curved. She had a smile.